I instinctively felt I didn't want to do any song that I didn't have a feeling for. I wasn't going to do a song just because I was suggested I should do it. So I let that feeling guide me. Just do what feels right, you know, and what feels fun. And we never took a formulaic approach.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Karen Hahn.
And I am usually your producer, but today I am your other host, Cameron Drews.
Hi, Cameron. So who did you talk to for this week's episode?
So the voice we heard at the top of the episode may be familiar to some. It belongs to none other than the legendary children's musician, Raffi. Karen, are you familiar with Raffi's work at all?
Oh my gosh, yes. Although that said, I don't know that I can name too many of his songs beyond maybe like Banana Phone and like Baby Beluga.
Yeah, I would say that Baby Beluga, which is a song that came out in 1980, is probably his most famous song.
Baby Beluga, Baby Beluga, is the water warm? Is your mama home with you? So happy.
Nice little song, right?
It's so nice. It's so, like, instantly, like, groovable.
I know. It kind of reminds me of some of, like, Paul McCartney's songs for the Beatles that kind of sound like they could be for kids, like, When I'm 64, sort
yeah,
of,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, Raffi has been a children's musician for the past four, going on five decades. His first kids album came out in 1976, so multiple generations of kids have grown up with this music. I was listening to him in the 90s. It was some of the first music I ever connected with, period. And I should also say that I got the idea to interview Raffi a while back, many, many months ago. Working co-host Isaac Butler mentioned that his daughter had been listening to a song called The Gummy Bear Song over and over and over, and he couldn't take it anymore. For reference, that song sounds like this.
Oh, I'm a gummy bear. Yes, I'm a gummy bear. Oh, I'm a yummy, tummy, funny, lucky gummy bear.
Oh, okay.
It's a little grating, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't call that, like, necessarily pleasant to listen to.
Right. And I'll be honest, like, I don't have kids, so I'm not that familiar with the children's music landscape. But when I think of contemporary kids' music, I think of stuff that is a little annoying, for lack of a better word. You know? Like, not that it's all annoying, but let's not forget about a song that was sweeping the nation and the world a few years ago, Baby Shark, which sounds like this.
Yeah.
Sort of an earwormy quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
But Raffi's music, it just isn't annoying. In fact, it can be really, really moving and pleasant. Like, one of my favorite songs of his is a song called Thanks a Lot from the Baby Beluga album. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the sun in the sky. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the clouds so high.
So not exactly the gummy bear song.
His music is, like, it's really beautiful, and it's also, it feels, like, more substantial, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, and that's what really strikes me about his music. It has endured for many, many decades. There is a lot of depth to it. So I wanted to talk to him about his process starting all the way back in the 70s. You know, how was he able to make such enduring kids' music?
Yeah, because again, as you say, he's been doing this for decades now. And like, I still instantly like recognize his name, and I think a lot of other people do too. And there's something weirdly comforting, like just based on the little clip we've already heard, about the way that he gives what is really such frightening advice, which is just do what feels right. But all right, so before we get to the rest of your conversation, what can Slate Plus listeners look forward to this week?
Well, in the main interview, you'll hear Raffi talk about a philosophy that he developed a couple of decades ago called Child Honoring. And in the Slate Plus segment, he tells me a little bit about a child honoring course that he offers through his nonprofit foundation. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, wow. I cannot wait to listen to that. Slate Plus members will hear that at the end of the episode, but if you're not a Slate Plus member but want to hear that segment anyway, why not join Slate Plus? As a member, you'll get no ads on any of our podcasts, unlimited reading on the Slate site, and member-exclusive episodes and segments from our show and other shows like The Waves, Culture Gap Fest, and Amicus. Sign up for Slate Plus now at slate.com/workingplus to access all of Slate's content and to support our work. All right. Let's hear Cameron's conversation with Raffi Kavukian.
Raffi, welcome to the Working Podcast. Thanks for being here.
Hello, we are working.
We sure are. So I actually want to start this conversation all the way back in the 70s when your career changed, right? You went from being a regular folk musician making music for, I guess, a general audience, you might say, and you started making music for kids. How'd that happen?
How did that happen? Well, I began my work with children singing in classrooms in Toronto. Mm-hmm. There was a program that used to pay folk singers like me to come into the classroom, sing a few songs. It might be kindergarten, grade one, grade two. I started, you know, gathering a little repertoire of songs to sing. Mm-hmm. It could be Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star for the real little ones, or Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. You know, just all kinds of standards and folk songs that little kids would enjoy. And that was quite a learning process for me. I was then married to a wonderful kindergarten teacher, very compassionate, who taught me all about young children as whole people. And that was quite an awakening for me, mm-hmm. to think of the young child as a whole person, to treat young children with respect. Respect became the core value throughout my whole career. So that was an early lesson learned well by yours truly.
And I definitely want to talk about the themes you explore in your music for kids. But first, I want to hear more about this musical pivot from playing to adult audiences and making music with them in mind to making music or performing music with kids in mind. Like, how would you describe the difference in those two modes musically?
The music with kids, is fun because it needs to be. Mm-hmm. You know, this was music that you would do at 10 o'clock in the morning instead of, you know, yeah. 8 o'clock in the evening type of thing. And it was fun. I noticed that I felt oddly relaxed in front of kids.
Yeah.
I didn't feel any pressure at all. And I was well coached by my kindergarten teacher wife as to, you know, how to go about these early sessions. So one thing led to another, and it was when I recorded singable songs for the very young in 1976. That first album of, well, songs that children could make their own, hence the word singable, that first album opened up a whole new career for me. It was very exciting, actually.
Yeah, and I want to talk about some of the specific choices you made on that 1976 album, and it's probably the choices you were making when you were singing in classrooms, too, because that album has a real assortment of songs, right? There are some pre-existing songs. There are sort of new takes on traditional songs. There are some songs that sound like complete originals to me. So how did you decide what that track list would be and just in general, what songs you wanted to do for kids?
Mm-hmm. Well, my then wife and her two primary school teacher friends, the three of them became the educational committee that advised me on what songs to include and so on. And so that was handy. And I instinctively felt I didn't want to do any song that I didn't have a feeling for. I wasn't going to do a song just because I was suggested I should do it. You know, you got to feel good about the material. You have to feel good about singing it and playing it on your guitar. So I let that feeling guide me. Just do what feels right, you know, and what feels fun. And so it turned into quite the blend of traditional songs and well-known songs, as well as a couple of, as we say in the music industry, third-party compositions, most uh-huh. notably Robin in the Rain, which is an old, old song from the 1940s, I understand. And then I added a couple of my own songs. One was called I Wonder If I'm Growing. Yeah. There was another song, the Sharing Song. There was one more that I wrote, Peanut Butter Sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So this eclectic compilation of songs became a hit really yeah. quickly. And the engineer on that very first project was none other than musician and producer extraordinaire Daniel Lanois.
Mm-hmm.
We recorded the album in the basement of his mother's home.
Yeah, for listeners who don't know, Lanois went on to produce for big name artists, Bob Dylan, Neil Young.
Yes, in fact, that album gave him his first gold album.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about some of the original songs on that album, but first, I am wondering, you said you had some people who acted as sort of advisors to you, but I'm almost wondering where they were picking these from. Like, I was, to take an example, The More We Get Together. I was trying to look up sort of the origins of that song. And if you Google The More We Get Together, your version comes up first. You've popularized that song. But when you try to look at how it existed before you, it gets a little harder. It's sort of an obscure song, and the melody dates back to 1800 or so.
There are certain songs that are well-known, and they endure because they are well-known. That song, The More We Get Together, is kind of an umpapa song. You know, it comes from Europe. It's a waltz.
The more we get together, 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 the more we get together, the happier we'll be.
And apparently it's been translated into a number of languages, and it never loses its original meaning. Mm-hmm. And in fact, decades later, economists came to call The More We Get Together the social capital theme song.
Oh.
Robert Putnam, an economist who wrote a book called Bowling Alone, uh-huh. called The More yep. We Get Together, the social capital theme song, because it contains a truism. When people get together, they are happier, yeah. generally. I mean, we're social animals, so it speaks to that. But generally, we were choosing songs that we, when I say we, my teacher friends, knew songs yeah. that children love to sing. Yeah. And a lot of these songs were well-known, and some were obscure, and so that was the process.
Yeah, I was even thinking about Peanut Butter Sandwich has original lyrics. It has a melody that is a little familiar.
Yes.
A peanut butter sandwich made with jam, one for me and one for David M. And a peanut butter sandwich made with jam, stick, 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 stick.
Is that another example of
correct.
Something that's just kind of in the air? Like, did you have to look up, oh, I'm using this melody, I need to see if someone owns it or something? Or were you just like,
well, yeah, I mean, you do a little bit of that. You don't want mm-hmm. to obviously use somebody's melody if it's copyrighted. Yeah, so yeah. those kinds of things, those considerations were there. Yes.
You know, some of these folk songs and these folk melodies may or may not have originally been composed for kids in their early version, right? And you have decided that they make good kids' music. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you take a song like Down by the Bay,
yeah.
which has become among the two or three songs that I'm most known for. It's a fun song to sing. It's funny. You know, you can make rhymes yeah. that are hilarious.
Yeah.
A goose kissing a moose, you know, or llamas eating their pajamas. I mean, it was like wide open, you know, what rhymes I could do. So I just went for hilarity, and boy, did that work.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
For if I do, my mother will say.
Did you ever have a time when you couldn't make a rhyme? Down by
the bay down by that bay.
Yeah, and it became my adaptation of a traditional song, which is often what can happen.
I love hearing you talk about how relaxed you were performing around kids and how much fun you can have with these songs. Can you talk about how your creative life opened up a little bit because of that?
Mm-hmm. The thing about making music for children is, you know, when you keep your audience in mind with respect for them as young people just at the beginning of life who are not only creative, but they're full of wonder, you know, then everything is fresh, everything is new. So you can sing a song about a butterfly, and that becomes, a joy, a source of wonder for a child. So, like with that first album, Singable Songs for the Very Young, because I wasn't recording it for radio, radio airplay,
right?
Then there's a wide open sense of what could be included, and so there's as there has always been in all of my children's albums, an eclectic mix of songs that generally wouldn't occur on a pop album or a rock album,
Yeah.
And I understood that right away, and I felt a freedom and a joy in doing that,
Yeah.
So it's fun again.
So I do want to talk about the original songs and original lyrics and the themes that you wanted to explore when you decided to make a kids album. And by way of example, I do want to talk about I Wonder If I'm Growing. It's a really nice song. It is, and you've done something interesting with it where you have taken on the perspective of a kid. The speaker of the song is a kid who is wondering if they're growing, kind of looking for evidence because it's not clear that they are growing.
I wonder if I'm growing. I wonder if I'm growing. My mom says, yes, I'm growing, but it's hard for me to see.
Tell me about that song and why you decided to include that one.
I drew on my childhood memory for writing that song. I remember being 4 and a half, and I couldn't wait to be 5,
Yeah.
I remember that as a young memory, as an old memory.
Right.
And I don't know, it just seemed to be a lovely sentiment to write about. I wonder if I'm growing. Every child wonders if they're growing.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, that song, that recording on which I used the nylon string guitar, actually one of the very few that I did that for, it had such a simplicity to it and a beautiful flute instrumental, a wooden flute. Something came together. There was an unselfconscious rendering of the vocal on my part and so on. So people came to love it. It touched them, And then, hey, I can reach the tap now for the very first time today. That's a moment in children's lives, and parents recognize that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, some wonderful things came together in that recording.
Yeah. So what other themes were you thinking about exploring lyrically with these songs when you were thinking, what do I want to communicate to kids? What will kids want to hear?
Well, with young children, the song topics that come to mind right away are songs that make you laugh, songs about animals.
Of course.
Songs about wonder.
Yeah.
Songs about the human body, like head and shoulders, knees and toes kind of thing. Plus, you draw on the traditional songs that have always been fun to sing, whether it's Baba Black Sheep or Sing When the Spirit Says Sing, or Six Little Ducks, And I was having fun in those first few children's recordings, sort of tapping the spectrum of what was available and what came to mind, and then also what I felt inspired to write, because I kept writing my own songs.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to the Corner Grocery Store album, the third album, I had written a number, and then Baby Beluga, that fourth album in 1980, I think that was the one on which the songs that I wrote, people were telling me they liked them as much, if not more, than the other songs on the album. And I went, wow, really? I was amazed. I was, you know, so my confidence as a songwriter for children and families was growing. And by Baby Beluga album, it was really something to get those accolades.
Is Thanks a Lot, is that on the Baby Beluga album?
Correct.
That's
yes,
that one of your prettiest songs, I think.
Thank you. And then there was another one that was a big hit on that album, All I Really Need.
Yes. Yeah.
And the recording of that is quite something. There's quite a... it starts with a... makes me laugh to think about it. It starts with an a cappella rendering of the chorus.
Uh-huh.
With some harmony. And then there's this big sort of drum fill...
Uh-huh.
That starts the song.
All I really need is a song in my heart.
And sometimes I listen to it and I go, gee, I did that.
You did the drum fill personally?
No. I mean, I chose that. Chose that as how to start the song, you know. When I say we, Ken Whiteley, who's an amazing multi-instrumentalist and musicologist friend of mine from the 70s, he and I and Daniel Lanois and the wonderful musicians we were working with, we just kind of went for it. We were just having fun, you know? But it's also interesting. We weren't trying to impress anybody. There was no radio airplay we were going for. So it was just, it was a very sort of, there was an innocence to the fun we were having, I would say.
We'll be back with more of Cameron's conversation with Rafi Kavukian after this.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, listeners. We want to hear from you. Whether it's to ask us for advice on a creative problem, tell us a guest you'd like to hear on the show, or share your own creative triumphs, drop us a line at working@slate.com or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, now let's return to Cameron's conversation with Rafi Kavukian.
I do want to talk to you about instrumentation a little bit. When preparing for this interview, I surveyed the children's music landscape a little bit, and I noticed a lot of, electronic instruments, programmed drums and stuff. You have, throughout your career, stuck with more traditional instruments, fewer electronic sounds. What kind of thinking has gone into those instrument choices?
I think when you hear that early work, you listen to it, you'll find that there's quite a wide range of instrumentation. The trumpet in Willoughby Wallaby Woo is beautifully played.
Yeah.
There's even a horn section in Baby Beluga, actually, that, which actually surprised me. It's almost like a Dixieland feel in the third verse. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
These choices came almost organically, just out of a sense of sheer fun.
Yeah.
And what would suit a song? That was always what we were going for. What would sound good on this song? How are we going to dress up this one? You know, type of thing.
Yeah.
And we never took a formulaic approach, ever, yeah. You know. It was just whatever a song needed or could use or, you know, wherever the whimsy could take us, you might say.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a pure creative way of doing it.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if there were any considerations. You know, kids like to listen to songs over and over and over and over again. And if you're a parent of a kid who's playing Baby Shark or something over and over again, you might get very annoyed. Is that like something you ever think about? Or are you like, parents are going to be listening to this? I don't want to get on their nerves.
Yeah, I won't comment on Baby Shark because I haven't even heard that.
But, okay.
But certainly I was aware that parents would be listening to these songs. And, you know, you make music not to alienate anyone. You just try and make good music. And that's what we were doing, is we were trying to make the best sounding, fun versions of these songs as we could do.
Yeah. So I want to pivot to some business decisions you've made in your career. You have made a point over the years to avoid, you know, excessive advertising and marketing. I even read that you turned down an opportunity to make a Baby Beluga movie, for example. Can you talk about that decision to avoid that sort of excessive commercialism directed right at your young audience?
Well, my record stands that I've never done a commercial aimed at children. In fact, I don't think I've ever done any commercials at all.
It was just
not what I was interested in. And there was no way I was going to take part in direct marketing to children. That's not ethical. It exploits the innocence of a young child who doesn't know what's being pitched to them. So right from the start, I just turned down every commercial offer that came to us. And there were quite a few, I might add, quite a few people wanting me to do commercials. And I just said no. And I'm proud of that. With the movie idea, there was no way I was going to take part in a movie for kids that would then be directed to them in direct marketing, that would then have all kinds of cheap products that would be sold at fast food joints and all that. I wanted none of it. Forget it. So it never took long to say no to these offers, because it's not what the music's about. It's not what my values are about. It's not what respect for children is about.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you need to reach an audience, or, you know, you need to make sure you're... I'm trying to think, like, if I were a slick Hollywood agent or something, I would say, like, hey, if you do more marketing and promotion, your audience would grow, you would reach more kids. Are you limiting your audience at all by not selling Raffy t-shirts or something?
I was reaching a lot of people.
Yeah.
I had sold out concerts from coast to coast, both in Canada and the United States. Yeah. So it wasn't like there was this huge need to suddenly expand my horizons. You know, I wanted my career to grow slowly enough that I could understand the changes it was putting me through.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want a rapid sort of growth of what I was doing. And I'm really happy that I stayed with that feeling, you know?
Yeah, was that a difficult decision?
No, it was just a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Just not to let things get too frenetic, not to grow too fast with it all, you know. There were milestones along the way. I mean, in 1984, I recorded my first concert video, a young children's concert with Raffi. And then in January of 86, Disney Channel aired it with not one edit.
Uh-huh.
And that was a big coup. Disney wasn't in the habit of doing that.
Yeah.
You know, so that really expanded the audience. And suddenly, folks who came to see me in concert saw me as a movie star or like a TV star.
Yeah.
Compared to just an audio recording star. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And you could always tell the ones who now saw me as a TV star because they were the ones in those days who brought cameras and wanted a photo of me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. So I want to jump forward quite a ways in time here and talk about your focus on climate action and environmentalism in recent years. I know you wrote a song called Young People Marching a few years ago that was inspired by Greta Thunberg.
Yes, but let's keep in mind, these are not songs aimed at children.
Okay. Yeah, so talk about that. Who are they aimed for?
Let me set the stage then. Let me give you some context.
Sure.
All along the way, I've had songs of appreciation of the natural world that we live in, that we depend on, a celebration of our big, beautiful planet and its marvels. Baby Beluga, that song itself, that album has a feeling of environmental appreciation, of course.
Yeah.
I think what happened along the way is, I don't know if you realize this, and people listening in may not know this, but in 1997, I got woken from a sound sleep by a vision, by a peak experience that gave me a philosophy, a unique philosophy, with just two words, child honoring. And that, when I responded to a clear calling to develop this philosophy and make it the work of the rest of my life, effectively in saying yes to that moment, I later figured out that I had said yes to a second career. So not only have I had a career making music, both in recordings and concerts for children throughout 4 or 5 decades now, but for the last 25 years, there has been this philosophy. It's a holistic vision that connects person, culture, and planet with the universal child as the heart of it, because all of us were once children, even if we don't have kids of our own. And children are children the world over, regardless of color, economic standing, or ethnicity. It's the human heart that's beating, and that's the huge good news of the interconnectedness of our species that we see most vividly in the very young of our species. That's an astonishing thing, if you think about it. So my climate songs, for example, 2007, I wrote one inspired by Al Gore, and it's called Cool It.
Uh-huh.
I call it the global cooling song.
Cool it, cool it, cool this planet down.
And then I wrote in 2019, inspired by Greta Thunberg, I wrote Young People Marching, which is quite upbeat, just like Cool It. Cool It's very upbeat in a rockabilly style. Young People Marching has a different style, but quite upbeat.
Young people speaking their truth to power. The science is clear. It's late in the hour for climate action. Reducing GHGs.
It's part of the songs that I've written and recorded throughout the last, 25 years, with child-honoring themes, actually, as well. Child-honoring has 9 principles. Respectful love, diversity, conscious parenting, emotional intelligence, nonviolence, caring communities, sustainability. I mean, it's quite comprehensive. and holistic.
Yeah.
The slogan of the Raffi Foundation for Child Honoring is respecting earth and child.
Mm-hmm.
That's the connection. I want parents to think of our planet Earth when they think of their children, because what is child-friendly turns out to be earth-friendly as well.
Yeah.
So it's respecting earth and child as a slogan can motivate you to make the right choices in your purchasing and so on. You see, so it's a holistic, it's a child honoring is a holistic vision of living consciously in the world. So the focus on climate, and I have focused on climate change.
Yeah.
I even have a poster that says Raffi wants you to join the climate movement. That's because climate, as you know, is the greatest threat facing our civilization. No one, I like to say, no one can guarantee a future, but who has the right to take it away? Who has the right to knowingly diminish our children's futures? Who has that right? And you better not answer Exxon. So these are serious matters for a children's entertainer to consider.
I know. Yeah, you were saying, you know, a song like Cool It or Young People Marching isn't for children. But were you saying that you do try and fold the themes of child honoring into your music for kids?
Well, there's got to be a distinction made here. In a way, all of my career for children has had child honoring values.
Right.
But the work of my nonprofit organization, I don't try and, you know, take that work and infuse it into my children's songs.
Yeah.
There's my music career, this is my child honoring work. They are, of course, related, but it's the job of adults to create a world fit for children, as they say at the United Nations, a world fit for children.
Yeah.
Because a world fit for children will be fit for all of us. You can't do it the other way. You can't go a world fit for adults and therefore it must work for young children. You can't do that. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Things grow from the ground up.
Yeah. Well, Raffi, thank you so much for joining us today on Working and talking about your great career and your wonderful songs.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Coming up next, Cameron and I will talk about following your feelings and considering your audience, so stick around. Cameron, that was such a wonderful conversation. I was so charmed by how much of Raffi's process seems to be influenced solely by intuition and feeling, which I feel like is something that no matter how much we talk about it on the show, we tend to find really hard to follow in practice, not just in terms of finding that feeling that you want to follow, but in terms of allowing yourself to follow it. I definitely put a lot of limits on myself in that respect, and I was wondering if you do too, and how you get around it and embrace it.
Yeah, it's tricky, and I'm really lucky in this regard because the primary creative work I do is audio editing for this show and other shows, and that's largely about following my own taste. You know, when I'm turning an hour-long conversation into a 30-minute conversation, for example, I'm mostly asking myself, am I bored right now? Am I excited? Am I confused? Like, what's my heart rate at this moment? And how do I adjust accordingly?
Right.
But when you are doing work from scratch, I agree that it can be a lot harder because you have to believe that your taste is enough and that it will get the job done, not just the taste of your imagined audience or your editor or the studio executive you sent your screenplay to. But I guess part of being an artist is hoping that your taste overlaps with your audience's taste, right?
Right. Like, you have to be conscious of, like, what you want before you can... I guess it's sort of like the thing they tell you when you get on a plane, where they're like, put your own oxygen mask on before you help anyone else with it. It's like, you need to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in that vein, Raffi also talked about having a, quote, unself-conscious rendering of the vocals on one of his songs being one of the reasons why it came together so well, which I think sort of connects to what we're talking about, like, you have to be self-conscious to a degree, but you can't be too self-conscious or otherwise yeah. you're ruining your own work. So it's something that's both easy and difficult to accomplish, especially because the older we get, the more self-conscious you get about what you're doing. And it's not always good to be unself-conscious. I guess this is a pretty similar question to my last one, but when do you know when it's necessary to be self-conscious? Is it all about audience, or is audience just one of the factors of it?
Yeah, audience is definitely a part of it. The way you perform for someone else is different than how you perform in a vacuum. The cliche dance like no one's watching, like that kind that kind of dancing is very different than dancing like your career depends on it or something, which is a situation we rarely get into, we non-dancers. But I also think that I was thinking about that a lot, the way he used that word unself-conscious. Like, it kind of sounds like he means singing without putting on a certain voice or a certain persona or thinking about how he should sound. And this is actually a problem I've noticed as an audio producer when I'm working with inexperienced podcast hosts. Like, they kind of want to put on a podcast voice. And I even, like, caught myself doing that in this interview a little bit, because I'm a little inexperienced. And when I listen back, I'm like, that's kind of my voice, but am I really, do I really sound like myself? And I think, you know, that song, I Wonder If I'm Growing, it's one of the only original songs on an album full of adaptations. On other songs, he can sort of hide behind an existing piece of art. And for this one, he was digging into his own experiences. And I think sounding like himself was artistically very important to that song. And but achieving that unself-consciousness is really hard. Actually saying, like, I am all this work needs the way I am, that's scary.
Yeah, it's terrifying to be vulnerable in front of an audience. And obviously I do want to talk about audience too, especially because I loved what he said about having respect for kids being key to his music and his success. Like, kids media is so often dismissed as lesser or unimportant or facile in some way, but I think culture is slowly coming around on the fact that that's simply not true. But it's still true that you have to change the way you're thinking to make something for kids, if that makes sense. Like, how much should you be considering your audience, and what kind of changes are you making because of that?
It's funny. I kept asking him questions that I thought would yield a more analytical answer about his audience, you know? But he would always come back with some version of A, respect your audience, and B, just have fun. And I think what works for Raffi is that he's compatible with his audience. Like, what he wants to play and sing about is sort of what his audience wants to hear. When he was talking about I Wonder If I'm Growing, he was digging into personal experiences and, you know, he was getting in the head of his audience a little bit. Like, he was sort of one with his audience in that moment. It was his experience and what the listener's experience is, probably. And, you know, he tapped into that. So maybe I'm overanalyzing this, or this is sort of like the, I don't know, this is quintessentially what Raffi should be. But I would almost say it's a mistake to say his music is aimed at kids. And it's more that, like, what he's exploring as an artist is what it's like to be a kid. And that's also what a kid wants to hear. So there's sort of an alignment there.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, I think that's why we don't like Baby Shark in the same way, you know, where like it is calculated to be for kids in that way. Like, it's like, you can feel it when you're listening to it. And to that end, your conversation with Raffi was so wonderful because he was so candid about having wanted his career to grow slowly enough that basically he could keep up with it and understand it. Like, a lot of what I want to talk about is turning out to be how clear-eyed he is about his life and his work, which is both very admirable and very unique. Or maybe it's just me that finds maintaining that kind of mindset really hard, but like, how do you process changes in your career? Because often it's easier to recognize and then navigate the fact that it's stagnating or going badly rather than progressing. And in the latter case, the impulse is to immediately accept whatever success you can.
I mean, in Raffi's case, he was dealing with a meteoric rise, right? Like, he was suddenly very, very valuable and people were offering things. But, you know, other artists will experience this on smaller scales if suddenly you do become a little more valuable or you're in a position where people are offering you things and you can say yes or say no. And how do you follow your artistic principles and not just like, oh, this will bring a financial reward or this will get me to the next level or whatever, because those are obviously important considerations. But it seems like Raffi mostly said no to opportunities that really go against his ethics or his artistic vision. Mm-hmm. And because he was successful, he was able to run those tests. You know, when I was preparing for this interview, I learned that Raffi has turned down Madison Square Garden and other big venues like that that want him to perform because he just said that's too big of a venue. It won't be an intimate enough experience. That's not the experience that I want to create for my audience. That's not the artist I am. But of course, it's not like he's choosing between Madison Square Garden and no performing. So it's easier to say no when there are other options on the table and you have that level of success. I don't know. What do you think about this?
I don't know. All of my decisions are obviously on a much smaller scale than Madison Square Garden asking me if I want to go. But it's like, I don't know. I've definitely taken assignments that I didn't really want to do, like, because I was like, this will pay my rent for this month. Like, I have to do this. And I've more recently been able to say no to stuff because I'm like, I'm not interested in it or I don't have time for it because I have money from other things, like from other like lines of income. So everything's on a much smaller scale. Like, I don't think I have had to consider like changes in my perceived level of success to like to this degree before. Or else this podcast would be very different. And this is somewhat separate, but hearing Raffi laugh about his own work is so lovely. Like when he's listening to the clips and laughs about it, because he said he performed the way that he did then because it felt right, because it felt suited to the song rather than being what the formulaic approach was. And it still clearly evokes that sense in him. Like he still enjoys the work that he did back then. I think it's rare to be able to look back and not regret anything about what you've done, even if you are working with that kind of mindset, because like I certainly have regrets about past work of mine. And it sounds like you do too, so I want to ask, how do you deal with it, and how do you then deal with it, or rather try to avoid that sense when you're making present work?
There's definitely work that I am embarrassed about, but I think if you look back at art from the past and you don't cringe, like maybe that means you're not growing and developing, you know? Like I think the cringe is proof that your taste has been refined or something. And I think there's a difference between looking back at art and saying, that's embarrassing, I wish I never did that. Versus looking back and being like, I would make different creative choices, but I actually was trying my best with that. And that was a pretty good try. And I learned from that. Like, I don't know if Raffi loves that drum fill he was talking about. Maybe he doesn't, but he was like, that was fun. And I'm glad that we had fun making that.
Yeah, I guess it ultimately comes down to like sort of being able to maintain a more positive outlook about stuff where it's like even... I think it's important in the consumption of all art or like the way that you perceive any art, like not just your own, where if you look at it and you see something you don't like, it's not something that if it's not like problematic and like a true problematic way, like then it's not something that like anger you, like you'll be able to understand it on some level because we've all made mistakes in our lives.
Yes.
We hope that you've enjoyed this show. And if you have, remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and then you'll never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Culture Gab Fest, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
This episode was produced by me, so thanks to me, and thanks to Raffi Kavukian for being our guest this week. I also want to give a special shout out to the podcast Finding Raffi, hosted by Chris Garcia. It was a big help when I was doing research for this interview, and if you want to learn more about Raffi, his life, and his work, go ahead and check out Finding Raffi wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's it for this week. We will be back next week with Karen's conversation with birder and ornithologist Isaiah Scott. It's going to be great. Until then, get back to work.